The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, I'm Gino Geraci. It's great to be with you. This week, it's turned out to be a big year for decisions coming out of the Supreme Court. We'll look at the big 9-0 case dealing directly with religious liberty that landed last week.
When cities and governments have this kind of broad discretion, they can't use that discretion in a way that punishes religious people.
Albert Mohler will bring analysis on what it means and why it matters.
It sends the signal that cities, states, had better be very careful about directly contradicting religious liberty.
The IRS denies a Christian group tax exemption
because of its biblical teachings.
Plus, Jack Phillips, the cake maker, is back in court.
What we have here is really incidents of harassment and targeting.
All this and more. I'm Gino Geraci, your host this week, coming to you from my home station, 94.7 FM The Word in Denver, where I host Crosswalk each weekday afternoon. You can hear my own program on 94.7 FM and 94.7FMTheWord.com. Take a moment to follow Christian Outlook on Twitter at TC Outlook. That's TC Outlook. And follow me as well at Geraci Gino. Great to be with you. We'll begin at the Supreme Court. On Wednesday this week, the court expanded First Amendment protections on student speech. It was an 8-1 decision. And by a 6-3 margin, the court strengthened private property rights by prohibiting union organizers from entering private property for the purpose of their union organizing efforts. But the decision we need to give attention to is a case that landed late last week, dealing directly with religious liberty. And the decision was unanimous. 9-0 in defense of religious liberty. Fulton v. Philadelphia is the case I'm referring to. We'll start with Jake Warner of Alliance Defending Freedom. He joined John Hall and Kathy Emmons on Word FM in Pittsburgh.
Let's first of all talk about the city of Philadelphia and Catholic Social Services. Lay out the case for us and then the surprising decision, by the court.
Yeah, there, the city of Philadelphia tried to force an adoption provider to place children with same-sex couples, even though it believed that children deserve to be placed in homes with a loving mother and father. And that was consistent with the adoption provider's sincerely held religious belief. So the city tried to punish them, try to keep them from placing any children in loving families. But the U.S. Supreme Court said that the city of Philadelphia could not target this religious adoption provider in that way. So they couldn't punish them from declining to place children outside of loving homes with a married mom and dad.
I see. And so, Jake, this was unusual. It's unusual, I believe, you know, just by looking at the case and seeing the victory in some ways, right? But also that there was a unanimous decision in this case. Yeah.
Well, I think that highlights that the free exercise violation here was pretty clear because the city of Philadelphia had basically broad discretion to allow any exceptions to its law. It said that it had to use that discretion to allow the religious-based adoption center there to basically operate consistently with their faith and place kids in homes of loving moms and dads.
Hmm. Okay. So were you surprised at the 9-0 ruling?
I was not surprised at that, just because of the way that the decision came out. Because the city had this broad discretion, the Supreme Court for years has said that when cities and governments have this kind of broad discretion, they can't use that discretion in a way that punishes religious people. And that's the decision in Fulton perfectly reflects that principle that's been long held for decades at the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, many of us who are champions of the First Amendment wish the court would have gone further than it did. But when the court issues a 9-0 decision, it sends a very clear message. Here's Albert Mohler from his briefing program.
You're looking at nine justices of the Supreme Court who unanimously struck down a policy of the city of Philadelphia that did not allow a religious charity in Philadelphia, Catholic Services, an historic foster care and adoption agency, to operate on its Catholic principles. It said instead that the LGBTQ non-discrimination policies, laws, and statutes of the city of Philadelphia meant that every single entity that did business with the city in any way, including in adoption and foster care, had to adhere fully to the LGBTQ non-discrimination policies of the city. And thus the city effectively shut down Christian and other religious ministries that had been operating in this very important work of adoption and foster care because, in this case, Catholic Social Services could not accept same-sex couples as validly married couples without violating official Catholic teaching. It was acting on Catholic principles and Catholic doctrine in what the ministry clearly believed was the best interest of the child. The Supreme Court's 9-0 decision did grab headlines. It was a surprise because when you're looking at anything that includes the initials LGBTQ, you are looking at what is deeply controversial. And in particular, everyone knew that this case pitted religious liberty over against the newly invented liberties of the sexual revolution. Time and time again, religious liberty has lost. It lost at the city of Philadelphia in terms of the city's policies. It lost even at lower federal courts, but it won at the Supreme Court, and it won big, 9-0. But as I said, that can mean many different things. Figuring out what it means is extremely important. At least the bottom line is this. It sends a double signal. Number one, it sends a signal on the issue. It sends the signal that cities, states, other legal jurisdictions had better be very careful about at least directly contradicting religious liberty. In this case, shutting down an organization like Catholic Social Services rather than to allow it to operate on Catholic principles. That's the first signal. The second signal is at least equally interesting. The nine justices together, six appointed by Republican presidents and three by Democratic presidents, has sent the signal that they really do not want a succession of cases presenting the same facts. A unanimous decision means that the court is effectively saying you don't have any hope of a different kind of decision if any case comes back to this court with basically the same facts. The majority opinion of the unanimous court was handed down by none other than the Chief Justice of the United States, John G. Roberts, Jr. And in the decision of the court, he points out the fact that the Catholic Church had been involved in foster care and in what we know as adoption ministries going back to the year 1798. So that's an important date for a couple of reasons. Number one, it establishes a very long-standing ministry, over 200 years. There actually aren't many locations in the United States where that is possible. The second thing is that it establishes the fact that the change in policy was not on the part of the Catholic Church nor Catholic Social Services, as it is known now in Philadelphia. The change in policy was on the part of the city of Philadelphia. It was the city that changed its policy. And once again, we see evidence of the inevitable results of the sexual revolution. The Chief Justice, speaking on behalf of the court, said, quote, "The Philadelphia foster care system depends on cooperation between the city and private foster care agencies like CSS. When children cannot remain in their homes, the city's Department of Human Services assumes custody of them. The department enters standard annual contracts with private foster agencies to place some of these children with foster families," end quote. There's a very interesting issue there that many Christians don't understand. Why is the entire enterprise of adoption and foster care now so entwined with what we might call church and state, the ministry side and the state or the government, the legal authorities? The answer is that the difference between 1798 and, say, 2021 is that the state has assumed legal authority for all children in this kind of crisis, all children. And so if there is a situation in which any court has intervened or in which there is any kind of intervention that is recognized by legal authorities, the adoption and foster care enterprise is ultimately under the custodial influence of the state. The state says, we take custodial responsibility for this child in crisis. We will partner with others. But notice what that does. It turns historic religious organizations into agencies of the state, or at least agencies hired by the state. That's the legal basis for the collision that took place in Philadelphia. And by the way, In no state is this fully avoidable. There is no state in which you could just set up a Christian foster care agency that would not entail the authority of the state, because the state claims authority over all of those children in need. The Chief Justice cited the fact that the religious beliefs of Catholic social services are longstanding, including the belief that, quote, marriage is a sacred bond between a man and a woman. The Chief Justice then wrote, quote, because the agency understands the certification of prospective foster families to be an endorsement of their relationships, it will not certify unmarried couples, regardless of their sexual orientation, or same-sex married couples, end quote. There's a key line on page 3 of the opinion handed down by the Chief Justice. It's a sentence that's very short, quote, but things changed in 2018, end quote. I underlined and circled that sentence because the Chief Justice is pointing to the agent of the change. It wasn't the foster care agency. It wasn't Catholic Social Services. It was the city of Philadelphia. The city changed the rules. And it did so in a way, say, all 9 of the justices of the Supreme Court, that was unconstitutional, because the city's policy was not neutral. It was anti-religious. In this case, it was anti-Catholic. It said that this official teaching of the Roman Catholic Church means that this Catholic agency was disqualified from working with the city in adoption and foster care. Now, there are other things we need to note in this. For one thing, there's a fog of disinformation. Just consider the fact that The Guardian in London ran a headline, quote, U.S. Supreme Court says foster agency can discriminate against LGBTQ people. Now, it's not so much wrong as it is a form of casting. What you have in that headline is the insinuation that the big issue here was whether or not there could be discrimination against LGBTQ people. That's not fair. The big issue here is whether Catholic social services could be Catholic. And the reason for that is actually made clear by the Chief Justice and by those who were attorneys for Catholic social services. There was no same-sex married couple that had ever applied and was ever even denied. Now, it would have been according to Catholic social services, but here you see something very revealing. The city of Philadelphia was operating with a very evident animus against Catholic social services. And if they're acting with that animus, with that opposition that is rooted in more than just a legal conflict, if they were responding that way to Catholic social services, they were actually responding that way to Catholic doctrinal teaching. Now, just take out the word Catholic and put in, say, Baptist, Presbyterian, Lutheran, or just about anything else. You see the point. The city of Philadelphia is not constitutionally competent to make judgments of that kind when it comes to theological matters. The Chief Justice summarized a key constitutional issue this way, quote, the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment, applicable to the states under the 14th Amendment, provides that Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. As an initial matter, said the Chief Justice, it is plain that the city's actions have burdened Catholic Social Services' religious exercise by putting it to the choice of curtailing its mission or approving relationships inconsistent with its beliefs. The city disagrees. But the court disagrees with the city.
Coming up, the IRS is at it again.
It's certainly not appropriate to exclude Christians engaged from tax exempt status because of its biblical teachings.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Stay with us.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy, and for over 2 decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. Many of you who've been around and tracking with news through the years of President Obama may remember well what is most succinctly labeled the weaponization of the IRS. This massive and powerful government agency turned against those who were seen as political opponents. There are hints of that in this next story. Leah Patterson is an attorney with First Liberty representing Christians Engaged. She joined my colleague in Tampa Bay, Bill Bunkley, from Faith Talk WTBN.
Our client is Christians Engaged, which is a Christian nonprofit organization that exists to educate and empower everyday Christians to pray for our nation and elected officials, vote in every election, and be civically engaged. It applied for tax-exempt status back in 2019, and just last month, the IRS denied that application, arguing primarily that it was political campaign intervention to, quote, educate believers on national issues central to their belief in the Bible as the inerrant word of God. That IRS letter, which you can read at our website, firstliberty.org, goes on to explain, quote, Bible teachings are typically affiliated with the Republican Party and candidates. So that's what the IRS did, and that's what we appealed 2 days ago on Wednesday. Basically, our argument is that the IRS violated its own regulations as well as constitutional protections for free speech and free religious exercise by making this decision.
Now, is this type of explanation, though we would totally disagree with it, is this something that usually comes with a denial letter?
Well, usually the IRS does explain the reasons for denying tax-exempt status, but I can tell you that the particular reasoning that they used here is rather unusual.
So let me ask this. I was just given a note that possibly there was a piece of literature the Christians Engage had as part of promoting their ministry that said something about lining up the Republican Party or something like that. Is that true or not true, or do you know anything about that?
No, that's not correct. Christians Engaged is a nonpartisan organization that engages people in civic activities. They teach people how to get involved civically and encourages them to pray for our nation and elected officials. So one of the key takeaways is that 501c3s are allowed to have positions on public policy issues, that political parties may also have positions of their own. So 501c3s don't have to be neutral on public policy issues. They just can't engage in political campaigning, such as endorsing a candidate.
Yeah, and as president of the Florida Ethics and Religious Liberties Commission, because we engage in policy issues in Tallahassee, that's why we are a 501c4, which allows going to even endorsing in campaigns, but certainly makes it clear that we're very much involved in the political process. Now, a 501c3, and of course I've been preaching this and saying this for years and years and years, as long as you're talking about an issue, if you're talking about abortion, if you're talking about gender rights, talking about this, that, and the other, and if you're educating folks about like House Bill 305, which is the making that up in the Florida House, that tells us that as soon as an unborn baby can feel pain, this bill says this and we're opposed to this bill. All of that is fair game. So it seems to me that my first reaction was, Leah Patterson, that this seemed like a very partisan, maybe bureaucrat or employee, by just jumping to the conclusion that they're going to deny someone because these issues happen to be some of the same issues of the Republican Party. Is that how you read it?
Well, I certainly couldn't speak to the particular motivation of the letter's author, but one of our arguments is that it's inappropriate for a government official to be determining what somebody's religious beliefs mean, and it's certainly not appropriate to exclude Christians Engaged from tax-exempt status because of its biblical teachings.
There's no question about it. The future of so much that people of Christian and conservative conviction care about is going to be decided in the courts. That's what our friend Jack Phillips has learned all too well. He's the cake maker from Denver whose case went all the way to the Supreme Court. And he's back in court again. Jonathan Scruggs with Alliance Defending Freedom explains with, once again, Bill Bunkley.
Jonathan, good to have you with us, and it looks like your job title is certainly right up the alley of this nonsense we're dealing with today, right?
That's right. We're staying busy, which is in some ways an unfortunate thing with our job security, but that's exactly right. So basically what happened, and I think you talked to Jack before, but
yes,
in 2017, an activist attorney called Jack and asked Jack to create a cake celebrating a gender transition Jack politely declined. He serves everybody, regardless of who they are, but he just doesn't create every cake request of them. And said, like, hey, I can create other things for you, but I can't create a cake celebrating this message, celebrating gender transition. And then that attorney essentially sued Jack in state court. And in the end of March, we had a full-blown trial. Jack testified, his wife testified. And we were feeling very confident, but unfortunately the judge ruled against Jack and basically said, no, Jack had violated the law and had discriminated about declining this cake. But really, again, it's just not true. This is the same thing we saw in Jack's first case, right? This is the same type of arguments that we've seen, and we feel confident we're going to appeal this decision because this really is about the freedom of all Americans not to be compelled by the government to speak messages they disagree with. And that's something the First Amendment protects. So we're going to appeal this decision, and we feel confident that we're going to win on appeal.
Now, I didn't hear you right, but this was not a jury trial, right?
Yeah, this is a bench trial. This is before the judge. Okay.
And so the bench made the decision. So in that way, he didn't overrule a jury, just so I make sure our audience knows. It was what we call a bench trial, and the judge makes the final decision. That was agreed to by all parties. And so is this the same judge that was involved with the previous initial case?
No. So if you're talking about Jack's first case, it went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes.
That went through the commission process. So what we have here is really incidents of harassment and targeting, really trying to use our judicial system like an arm of cancel culture to punish someone simply for holding certain religious beliefs about marriage.
Now, I know in the state of Florida, Jonathan, if we had a lawyer that kept playing these games, there is sanctions that the Florida bar could take to shut him down from doing this. Any such remedy like that in Colorado?
Well, I mean, we definitely asked for attorney's fees at the very beginning of this case for a motion to dismiss and attorney's fees. And that was something that, again, unfortunately was rejected by the judge. So this is something that's going to have to be taken up on appeal and will be decided either by the higher Colorado appellate court or maybe eventually again by the U.S. Supreme Court. Because you see these types of cases happening across the country, not just with Jack Phillips, but you might be aware of the Forest in
yes.
Washington, Baron L. Stuntzman. Who again was sued and has her livelihood on the line, being sued for her personal assets, her home, in effect, is on the line. So what you see is these laws, again, being used as a way to punish particular people who hold certain beliefs, to target them because of the beliefs they hold, and to punish them, to drive them out of the industry. And this, you know, these type of laws won't just be used against Jack and Baronell. They'll be used against other people as well, and it's quite unfortunate.
Coming up, getting back to church.
Your relationship with God is central. It should be the most important relationship in your life.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Gino Geraci. The pandemic has been hard on church life in our nation. Many churches adapted well. Some met outside, some met in limited capacities, and many started meeting online. Doing church by Zoom does absolutely have spiritual benefit. But it's not church life as it was intended to be. It's time to go back to church. That's the argument from Melanie Rayner and her piece for the Gospel Coalition. She joined Brian Fromm and Aubrey Sampson on AM 1160, Hope for Your Life, out of Chicago.
One of the things that you talk about in this article is the other side of the argument, which says, hey, you know, we're choosing to worship in spirit, not in person. If Paul worshiped from prison, we can worship from our TV screens or from our phones. And you answer really emphatically, no, we need embodied worship. And so we would just love to hear more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the impetuses for writing this article was dealing with my own and my co-writer's own experiences during the pandemic. So what about church became sweeter by being at home? And what did we end up missing? What are the things that left us wanting more? And so why did God create this innate longing in us to gather with his people and worship his name. And we felt like scripture offered so many indicatives for that. And so our imperative is to gather as the church. But I think about, like, back in the early days of the pandemic, you know, we were recording our church services on Thursday to show on Sunday. And Sunday mornings became this really sweet time with my family. I have two young kids, two young girls, and Sundays are normally anything but a family day, right? Like, because we're running around and we're getting ready. And as pastors, you guys understand, I get up at the crack of dawn and I leave and I see my kids and they show up at church. And all of a sudden, Sunday mornings were slow. And we made pancakes every Sunday and we sang together. And it was just this very sweet thing, but something was missing. And so as soon as the church doors opened, we were back and so many of our friends were back. So what is this longing that the Lord had created in us? Even though we can worship, we did worship, we participated in the life of the church from a screen, but it didn't feel full. It didn't feel complete. God placed this longing in our hearts to be together as the communion body of Christ. So that was a lot of what we wanted to explore.
That's really good. Melanie, we're all reading statistics. Here in Illinois, things are kind of behind where you guys are in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of at the front end of reopening and all of this stuff. But all the statistics we read, or we heard Craig Rochelle said this week out in Oklahoma, that kind of across the board, people are slow to come back. And I wonder if, you know, if only half the people are coming back at this moment or whatever else, why do you think that is? What does that say about kind of the perception people have had of church and why people are feeling, quite frankly, comfortable not going back right now?
So I think there are a couple of things at play there. I think there is this amazing opportunity to be re-engaged in the world. And so I know from our congregation and from friends, you know, everyone is traveling and they're seeing family and friends that they haven't seen in 2 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
So by its very nature of being a weekend activity, I think that people are doing things on the weekends that they haven't been able to do and seeing people that they love and doing those things. But I think that somewhere in our sort of Western individualistic perception of our relationship with Christ, it's become, well, what am I doing with Jesus? Hmm. So am I worshiping? Am I doing my devotions? Am I reading my Bible? And so how do we remind people or teach them for the first time that gathered worship as a body, that engaging in community are critical pieces of our Christian walk when so much has become individualized because of sort of quiet times and those sorts of things that we grew up with? You know, how do we teach people that gathered worship is the central expression of our faith and of our walk, and it has been for centuries? And so I think there's a retraining and a reteaching. But there's inviting people into the sweetness of that we have to, our lives should revolve around church. Church shouldn't fit into our very busy American lives.
What would be your encouragement to those people to maybe take a step back into Christian community?
I would say that your relationship with God is central. It should be the most important relationship in your life. But as part of Christ's incarnation and as part of the way that God created the local church, it was for us to be in community. And that is one of the most beautiful gifts that the Lord gave us, is Christian community. It's in being the body of Christ. And Paul talks about this all of the time. And a body is made up of many parts. When we're all together, there is a community that is built. You will lean on that community in ways that you don't even see now.
Coming up, Victor Davis Hanson looks on the 2020s relative to the 60s.
This thing is very different. This is top down. They've won their long march through our institutions, gone.
The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
It had to be you. It had to be you.
As we consider a post-COVID world, the call goes forth to a new generation of leaders in politics and policy. I'm Pete Peterson, Dean of Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. And for over two decades, we've prepared students to apply America's founding principles to today's policy debates. Are you considering graduate school? Find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci, host of Crosswalk on AM 990, The Word in Denver. As we've watched this last turbulent year of our nation unfold, many of you are with me in trying to understand what's going on in our nation. From BLM and critical race theory to the social justice movement, we're living through a pivotal time in our nation's history. But the 60s were a turbulent time as well. How do the 1960s of the 2020s compare? Historian and prolific author Victor Davis Hanson joined Don Crow on WAVA in Washington, D.C.
Talk about what those days were like back then and how different they are from today.
Well, there were leaders, and they had agendas, and they were left, if not Marxist, but it was scattershot. It was sort of a grassroots. One day they would go to Altamont or Woodstock. The next day they might march on the Pentagon, or they would demand free speech or pass-fail grades. It was just sort of a cultural revolution everywhere. It could entail wearing your hair long or getting rid of your plastic frame glasses and wearing wire rims or not shaving your legs, but it was ill-organized. I mean, there were the Weathermen, the SDS, the Black Panthers, but they were the exceptions, and they were the, you know, dead-enders that went into the 70s. But this thing is very different. This is top-down. They've won their long march through our institutions, gone.
Talk about the fact that back in the 60s, there were those who argued, well, even at that, whatever limited revolution, in quotes, there was then, reform was really needed. But you argued there were already some good reforms that had been made or were in place or were in process, right?
Well, all of the great civil rights leaders, Ralph Abernathy, Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin, they were all active in the late 50s and early 60s. And they were making enormous progress by the moral force of their arguments. This is before Rap Brown and Stokely Carmichael and the Black Panthers in the 60s and the hippies. And there had been a woman's movement since the 20s. And it was on a trajectory to give women equal pay for equal work. So the 60s stuff took credit that they accelerated it. Maybe in some cases they did, but they also made it far cruder. And they brought us a lot of pathologies we have today of broken families, high divorce rates, single parent families, agnosticism, atheism, a lot of stuff. But they were at least given credit. They were not part of the establishment, at least at that time, that they hated. They were not worshippers of mammon. They claim maybe there were a lot of hypocrisies, but this group is, I mean, they're not marching on the Pentagon. They're inside the Pentagon. They control the curriculum of the reading list for soldiers. They control the methods of promotion. They control the Joint Chiefs. This is, and we could go through every institution and say that the establishment from Wall Street to social media to the university president, they are as woke as 60s people outside on the street, if not more so.
By 1981, you write, the Reagan Revolution finished off the dead-enders of the Woodstock generation. Most eventually grew up, rebooted their self-centered drug, sex, party impulses to fixations on money, status, and material things. And I guess the question is then, if that were the case, why did it not die on the vine then? How are we now so radicalized?
Well, these things are periodical. And I think what happens is that once things are set right, whether it's Giuliani's anti-crime program in New York, continued by Bloomberg, or whether it's the Reagan Revolution, 12 years of Reagan and Bush, then people get complacent and they think, you know what, it's safe, we're secure, we can do this, we can get rid of broken windows policies, we can allow, you know, lesser penalties for crime, we can do it, and they get lax. And so we get in this cyclical pattern. That's what we're in now.
Well, we all know the phrase from years ago, barbarians at the gate. Obviously, they're not only inside the gate now, but you're saying they are in the centers of power. They have the control mechanisms and levers, if you will, in their hands. You call them the woke grandchildren of the former outsiders. So although it's much different, the seeds were sown back then that we're now reaping. Am I right?
I think so. I mean, there were a lot of thinkers that said, you know, this revolution failed because we weren't focused on the institutions. And so I think over the last 20 years, Americans were asleep at the wheel as Wall Street turned woke. Gradually, a corporate boardroom at Delta or Coca-Cola is woke now. And all the universities are woke. and K-12, Hollywood, the entertainment, Silicon Valley, of course, major print. The only things that aren't are talk radio, maybe, and some blogs, alternate. But everything else, they have the controls of influence, capital, money, media, education. And even though they have a minority of support in the country, they're not a majority. There's none of these issues that they're advocating for ever poll in any survey 50%. Open borders, no way. New Green Deal, no way. Critical race theory, no way. Just don't. So they're implementing them from on top. They love the chain of command, so to speak, especially in the military, where they can, by fiat, just order social change, and you obey your superior.
Well, on that point, you say the woke and wired new establishment knows how to use their money and power to rebirth America as something the founders and most current Americans never envisioned. And you have already alluded to that, but you say name one mainline institution the woke left does not now control. And I think that's what a shocker for so many average Americans, who say, how did Silicon Valley get such power? How did the professional sports world get such power? The ultimatums being handed out by these major entities now that really are even intimidating some of the biggest corporate entities. I think we let them.
I think we were complacent. We on the traditional side, we just thought, you know, we have our family, we have our community, we have our jobs. That's a handful. And we let a small vocal minority go to these corporate people and to Wall Street and to professional sports and say, if you don't do this, we're going to deplatform you. We're going to cancel. I think social media really accelerated that, Facebook and Twitter, internet. But we didn't, we thought, you know, we don't do that. We're above all that. And yet, if you want to save your culture, you're going to have to say, you know what, we're going to go to a school board meeting. And for every person who tries to yell at us, we're going to stand firm. And we're going to say, you know, I'm not going to resign my job if you call me a racist without any grounds. I'm just not going to do it. You're going to have to fight that. And I think everybody is slowly now waking up. It's like a sleeping dragon. And I think we'll see what happens. The proof of the pudding will be the midterm elections. I don't think it'll do the Republicans much good to squeak by. They have to get a big majority win in the House and then take back the Senate. And if they don't, I don't see how you stop this stuff.
Coming up,
there is no forgiveness there. Mm-hmm. There is just constant penance. There is no redemption.
Vody Bachum, when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Gino Geraci. I'm not telling you anything new when I tell you our nation is increasingly secular. And like Victor Davis Hanson pointed out, the hard left today has the levers of power. They are aggressively advancing a worldview that is antithetical to Scripture. The problem is, there is sin, but no forgiveness. Of course, that point is relevant for us as believers before a holy God. But it's also very relevant for that sort of culture and society and institutions we shape together. I turn to pastor and author Vody Bachum.
You make a case that the Bible really does give us accurate information about reality.
Yeah, it does. We're having a discussion right now about some incredibly important issues. We're having discussions about race, about human sexuality, and people are open about this in the public square. Mm-hmm. And as a Christian, I don't just think, but I know that we have the authoritative source on these matters and the only one that will give answers that will satisfy in the end.
You want people to actually try to overcome that statement that you don't get it, that you don't ideologically get it or philosophically get it. You don't get it. And what you're saying is, no, I get it perfectly, but you're offering the wrong tool to solve the problem.
Yeah, and I want people to understand where this stuff comes from and what it's connected to. These things come to us from this sort of neo-Marxist ideology. Mm-hmm. And I want people to recognize, yes, there is racism. Yes, there is oppression. Yes, there's all these things. Yes, 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 yes. But we need to understand them from a biblical perspective, from God's perspective. And then we need to respond to them from a biblical perspective, from God's perspective.
In your book, in chapter 4, you entitled it A New Religion. And this came as a shock to many people who are trying to understand this movement. It really is a worldview, but it is a religion because they have a belief about what's wrong and how to solve the problem, and they are offering a solution. But in this new religion, it bears no resemblance to historical biblical Christianity, does it?
No, it really doesn't. And that's really because there is no forgiveness there. Mm-hmm. There's just constant penance. There is no redemption. You just have to do the work of anti-racism. And the work of anti-racism is never done, especially when you start from the premise that white people and America are inherently and irredeemably racist, mm-hmm. and that white people are incapable of righteous actions in the area of race. If that's where you start, then you can't end up with anything other than perpetual guilt, seeking perpetual atonement.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. If you enjoyed our program, take a moment to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Google Play, and never miss these and other great conversations. Start at ChristianOutlook.com. Thanks for joining us today. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. For executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards and David Pishon and Mike Cook, I'm Gino Geraci. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook. So she ran away in a sleep.